We are in Tempe, Arizona, at the Education Innovation Summit of Arizona State University. And my guest at this point is Nelson Broms, who was also at the Education Prize meeting that we did at the Salk Institute. Mm-hmm. Earlier, Nelson is principal and co-chairman of the Crescent Group. There's a whole list of things which you can find on the website describing what he's done, but primarily I'm interested in the fact that it says here on your Arizona State University card, Office of the President, Distinguished Social Entrepreneur.
Exactly.
So I'm taking that to mean that you are interested in certain social issues. People come to you for advice, and you deliver such advice. So I'd like to know what you think, where we are at with this giant problem.
Well, by the way, you know, people say I'm an advisor. You're an advisor. I say, well, I'm not an advisor. I'm a devisor. Then we devise, and then we go and do it. That first. We have a system that's not a system. The term system would perhaps speak to the system of being a human being with blood that picks up air and then circulates it and on and on and on. We are not a system. We are a series of fiefdoms that kind of touch each other at the margin. A system? Okay. We should be, tomorrow morning, for instance, I don't know whether this is, but I'm meeting with one of the professors here, whom I've known for a couple of years, on supply chain. We should be trying to be seen as a supply chain, you know, and the elements be a part of a process rather than competing or indeed combating with each other. So we go away from this meeting, having first been moved so much by Michael Crow. And now we have to get out into the details, where the devil is. And much of it gets to be kind of what you would have expected otherwise anyway.
When you say fiefdoms, though, are you saying the thing that we tried to avoid at this last meeting? Let's not go round and round and round again with complaining about teachers or complaining about school boards or...
Exactly. We did that.
Says, how do we educate in a rapidly changing world? How do we focus information and technology to produce meaningful change?
What we did here was good in that it brought together parties of very different parts of the whole to meet, and more than anything else, I'd say it was basically that. So we're hearing the spirit of entrepreneurship here, which is a very different thing than the tried and true people who've been doing this for 20 or 30 or 40 years, or in my case, a little more. And they are inspirited, but the people who should be moved to make the change, how about the teachers' union? They haven't been seen here. You know, they are they're a lobby with some 5 or 6 million votes that they can be responsible for. They're not here. How are we going to change without dealing with people who, in a sense, have the ultimate veto?
Well, but when you talk about things like supply chain or the pipeline, some people get very nervous and think you're talking about a conveyor belt just churning out students at the other end. Plainly, nobody's talking about that. Plainly, we understand that education is an art as well as a science.
It is indeed.
In terms of what we were talking about in our last meeting, where we were talking about how you use incentives to produce innovative changes in education, plainly one of the things you need to do there when you've devised competing strategies that you want to try out is some way of measuring them. You've got to get results driven, so there are metrics. And I sometimes wonder that if this whole notion of adding in economic terms and metrics and so on, you have to have that to find out whether the thing is working or not. That's not dehumanizing, is it? It's just giving you better data with which to assess yourself.
If you stay only with the metrics, then you have dehumanized. Metrics only. And let's face it, subjectivity is part of the final decision in one way or another anyway, given whatever you're given, I think. And so, but we have to go from zero to something that gives us an idea what a slide rule should look like, and then begin to grope our way along to further defining and refining and finding. And I think the meeting we had around that open U was a very good meeting, which made the point. So there have to be some recognition along the way, a pat on the back, or literally a financial result that is measured.
So what's your...
You know, when a kid is moved, how do you measure that? You know, scores, further development, yeah, but not metrics only.
You said something very interesting to me yesterday when we were just wandering around, which was that, and I'd like to get some sense of your philosophy, your own vision here. You said, well, to some extent, this is a vision. This is a business that should have more poets and philosophers.
Poets and philosophers.
Because if
exactly.
all you've got is economists and businessmen, Amen. You're going to be lacking some peripheral vision.
Amen.
There.
Amen. Exactly. Right.
So, what's your sense of how this goes from a?
Well, you need to have some people in there that are able to be all of them. You know, there are some. There are some people who are founders. Can I mention that Chris Whittle is... Chris Whittle is certainly a founder.
Yeah.
But founders then need people who run things for the vision. And they as leaders, should be able to inspire others who do things they can't quite do as well. And many people can be founders, but not ultimately the operators who operate to the result. Michael Crow happens to be one that has it all. Clearly all. Here it is. Evidence in real estate and tons of people and so on. So, poet and philosopher, yeah. Yeah. But not without understanding there is such a thing as accounting and accountability. Yeah.
How do you tackle, though... I mean, because you've had experience of lots of these things over a distinguished career. How do you take something which so quintessentially involves developing individual personalities and individual databases,
one teacher at a time,
and yet is a huge monolithic system? Those are obviously
in other places there are tsunamis which come and sweep it all away, and then you have to start all over again. Now, you couldn't begin to imagine that when you have the millions of people who are in their jobs and doing their work and, you know, and they've been doing it for 20 years and have them change to a spirit of change to this degree. Change, you know, we're talking about revolution here. We need revolution. You know, one more time, we've got to get moving here. And then the meeting ends, and there's another meeting 60 days from now called by another group, and we're saying the same thing. So how do you do that with great difficulty? Great difficulty. Now, here, we're in a place that, you know, right here, we know we're here, right, at this location, where there is a leader who understands and has shown with an entity, an enterprise that roughly would have 100,000 people in it over a period of 8 years, follow through, building, further results, further expansion, the ability to do that. And he's got a level of hundreds of people that now would be following him, which certainly includes me. How do you do it with millions of people? And time is of the essence. Time is of the essence. We really don't think time. It's interesting. I found that in other places as well. You know, all the stuff is put out there, and they say it's a 2-year plan or a 5-year plan. We don't accord time the regard, because all we have as humans really is time, but that's another matter. So how to do this? You have to do it with great difficulty. And, you know, here we go again. We've got the great government telling it what it be. Until it gets down, you heard the reverend speak today, until you get down there you know, in the barrio and get down there and down there and down there. That's the only place. So I you know, I'm founder of a conservative think tank, so I would think this way. But I think what we have to do is do it around government, around the government.
But you're talking about you're talking about Michael Krobe specifically here. We're at ASU, Arizona State University, which is dubbed the New American University.
Yep.
Excuse me. And yet, my understanding is, and I don't live here, that this is not a state which has a particularly great record for being supportive of education in general.
No. I mean, you know, he was he was being excoriated on the front page of the local newspaper, papers. You know, who the hell does this what SOB think he is coming in here and telling us what to do? But here he is. So he's been able to withstand that and continue ahead and get it done and get it happening. Global as well as local, how do you do that? You're only a, you know, a state college. He's done that. 8 years. I don't know that we have 8 more years from here, for instance, before the, you know, this is doomsday, before there's a complete collapse in the core of our and by the way, and here at this meeting, we go on to speak to other areas of the world and repeat to these people, you know, the numbers and the seriously shocking numbers and the pace of change, you know, and the expectation. If we don't get a grant for Race to the Top, then I guess we are where we are and we continue as we are. We have 100,000 principals, 100,000. We have 15 to 16,000 districts. None of them are run by people who were really measured as businesses by accountability and accounting. An enormous turnover there. So the business would be to stop. There was a great show many years ago on Broadway and so on. Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. Remember that? Well, it's kind of Stop the World, I Need to Get Off so that we can get the time to change it. How do you do it? With enormous difficulty. You talk the talk, you see an incidental thing, you see a program like KIPP, a marvelous thing like Wendy Kopp and what she's done and is doing, and what we're doing here at ASU in concert with her. These are individual, I'd call them inspirations.
Wendy Kopp is the Teach for America program, right?
Yes, she's kind of a simple lady. She said, why don't we get energy in here with people who want to do something rather than have all the pedagogic training to then be certificated to become a teacher? And this too. Now, tens of thousands, indeed hundreds of thousands, I say by this time, have come through her program. I'd say in the years that she's been at it, maybe hundreds of thousands, yeah. So it's got to be happening, and the way it is. But if there was martial law, maybe we'd then go out and see how to begin to command it from the center.
But you'd have to.
There are almost 4 million teachers out there. That's 4 million individuals. Okay. They've been doing it that way, and it's an honorable undertaking. And so the elements like pay more and recognize more haven't been instituted and really can't be, because now comes the financial thing and the money that isn't coming, and certainly now with less there. So how can we even undertake an idea like doing that? And so it's not going to happen because of money. And it's interesting that, well, anyway, I don't want to make a speech here on that. How do you do it? With great difficulty, and hopefully you can get a Michael Crow times 100. That would take some doing, who continue to do that, and maybe there's a slow change in attitude. Teachers are the thing. We're doing things here. Well, I don't want to get into that. This sounds like ASU. Chris Whittle, what Chris is into now, creating a business, okay, again, and which is for private schools. Great model, okay. 30,000 students.
One thing that I noticed...
Not 30 million, not 50 million, not 60 million. We have an increasing population here in this country. God bless it. Immigration has a lot to do with that. The demographics here are good, as against some of the other mature countries. Like Russia is losing population, so we have an increasing population. So we have increasing population... certainly with hordes of people coming into this country all in bunches, and every one of them has to... Here, this state right here is subject to that more than just about most other, you know, the inflow of immigration, and now they're here, now they have to be in school. So it's an enormously complicated thing with constituencies of size and different intent. Still. So if we could get them all on the same page, literally, one with their 3 or 4 million, one with their 50 or 60 million all together, and that isn't going to be done by the Secretary of Education, maybe by the President with some executive order, but it was... So you just keep, you know, you keep this. I wish I could say it differently, you know. I certainly realize myself that time is of the essence. That's very personal, very personal.
I noticed what I was going to say when I was almost interrupted you there was that in talking to Chris Whittle, that his vision is a global vision. I mean, he's talking
absolutely
schools all over the place.
Oh, yes, schools spotted in places where you start understanding what it is, and so you go there and you do it. We started growing up in an agrarian country, so that, you know, and take the whole summer off because you've got to work on the farm. We've perpetuated that to this day. We've got other countries with high work ethic. You know, 6 days of school, more hours of time. We've already proven that people in the lower income areas and people of color, too, give them another hour a day. It's amazing what change that can be. 1 hour a day. And we haven't been able to get that because there are others who have contracts and say, well, here's the contract. Can't do that. So it's attitude, intention.
And innovation and technology.
Yes, that's going to...
One of the interesting talks I heard was from...
That might save us.
From Google's education evangelist.
I call that two thumbs up. No, I'm in it.
So you were there when he told that story about being in Africa, having somebody standing in front of him saying, we need computers, and behind him were kids doing the two thumbs up.
Yes.
They already had a platform that was an information technology platform. They didn't really necessarily need huge paperweights. They
exactly.
just needed...
Exactly. No, I'm glad you said that. There are numerous studies which speak to people of lower income with families that have been studied on site by people who've gone there. And in lower education parented households, children have heard perhaps 5 or 10%, perhaps, of words that children in higher educated families have heard. So the neural tracts are not quite there in the 4 or 5 years before they go to school. So here comes preschool now. Well, organizing preschool is enormously necessary so that you prepare them to be there. And so this has been a difficulty where kids, you know this, kids of color, let us say, get in there 4 or 5 years old, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, and then when they get to about fourth grade, they hit a wall. And then that difference begins to widen. And that's it. Now then, bless the, what I call thumbs up. You'll see the kid sitting there, but he's got a little something and he's using his fingers and he's figured out how to do that. And he's 2 years old and he's not being read to. So you just alluded to that. That may give us a chance to jump over that chasm.
Yeah.
And attach to a higher developed technology to ride on. That, I think, is the only thing that might save us. Might save us? Yeah. Those, I think, are appropriate words. Yes. Two thumbs up.
So, how did you get interested in this whole field of education in the first, because this is not...
I became involved in a charter school before there were charter schools in Harlem, in New York. A friend of mine was there, and so I went to this building one day. They had about 300 kids there, all black, sea of black faces, and went in there and up some, literally a bombed out building, you know, the steps were awful and so on, but you get up there on the second floor and there you see kids' uniform, chino pants and a polo shirt. That was the uniform. So they all uniformed in there. And they were chosen by random from single family parent or foster homes. Random. 15 block radius. Middle of Harlem. And these kids were chirping. And as you walk down, and I've made that point, I think, with you before, these kids are looking you in the eye, looking you in the eye as you walk down. I brought Steve Forbes there some months later, and he made the same comment. And so that's how I got involved in a non-char. They'd been able to go to the city to implore and get them to agree to permit them to do some things about changing the rules in this spot on West 113th Street in the middle of Harlem. Now, I make the point that the Columbia, the main campus, is at 115th and 16th Streets and around there, and Broadway. And so they're on the edge of Harlem, actually. And one day I invited Michael out to
go
and
take a look. Michael Crowe, who was
then? He was executive vice provost of Columbia. And Michael and I go back a long way. And so that's how I first got involved with seeing what effect could come from real teachers, real dedication, and effect on these kids. And that grew and grew and grew, and then they changed. And then so that's how I first became involved. As a business, I was aware very much of Edison having been created for profit company, public company, and what they were doing. And as I've said, they were doing God's work. And so I became involved with some of the things that Edison was doing that led me to Edison. We took private Edison, and I've been a counselor to Edison ever since
Edison Schools, of course,
Edison
being
Chris Whittle's invention,
yeah.
20 years ago, groundbreaking at the time, and a for-profit company. Rather than a not-for-profit, that's there's a little difficulty there because the Secretary of Education, who is hiring others to manage some schools, as we at Edison do, has repeatedly said that he's prepared to do that, but only with not-for-profits. There's a bias of some kind there, and so on. Not for Edison, but the general idea.
When we talk about, at our last meeting, about this education prize, which therefore would have invited people with different solutions, different technologies to compete and see how things worked out, this proliferation of possibilities fits in very nicely with... let me backtrack. This proliferation of possibilities, in other words, this is against the whole notion of a monolithic system.
Yes,
now, plainly you need some large organization to deal with a large number of people. Even John Stuart Mill, in his book on liberty, said that one of the things that he thought there ought to be a state system for was education, because he thought everybody should have one. It was one of the few little things that he talked about where you know, he thought it was a given that you should have an education. But he also added there that he thought it should be allowed, there should be alternative school could be set up as well. So he didn't want to impose one version of school.
John Stuart Mill said that when?
Well, I guess On Liberty was written in 1859.
What was the population then?
Not as big as it is now.
And what was the profile of the population then? And on and on.
It's all changed.
That was then, and this is now.
Yeah.
Okay. So these things popping, and yet we are more individuals. The kids can go on all day with this, you know, and more of that, and God bless it. So it may come again by having gone from to the ultimate retail consumer, i.e. the child, because nobody represents the child today. Not the unions, clearly. Not the school districts.
Parents?
What's the percentage of parents? Peter Drucker was a dear friend of mine. He used to say, I'm going to say it. Americans say they are concerned about their children. They are not. Peter Drucker, in my presence more than one time.
So part of the solution is to get...
We say the parents, we're not the parents. You know, let's face it. It's not like it used to be. Down on the farm, there were farms when John Stuart Mill made those statements. There were farms. The kids had to bale hay and pick cotton and bale cotton. These are different times. The cycle that speed now controls a good part of what we do. More gigabytes, faster, 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 faster. Okay. So we are more individual in our own experience, in our own selves, with the text messaging as well. And therefore, in time, it may ultimately be the final connection between the retail consumer, the child, and the provider that could be a variety of things, you know, a teacher. We're proving it. This may save us, technology, but technology in a way so that, you know, there's technology for keeping your accounting records. That goes back 100 years with IBM. I think technology, broadly writ, is the thing that might save us.
So when...
And the consumer, and nobody in between, some provider through some mechanism that can go out. And the bigger the company, the more impressions.
So when... He came into office in his inaugural address and later in an address to the National Academies of Sciences. President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah.
Didn't give the coordinates of that. So I've been asking people as I go around, what do you think is the rightful place of science?
Of science? Well, science is the ultimate human expression of intelligence, let's put it that way, and therefore... it's like math as well. STEM, it's a requirement that we polish our native whatever into being able to reason more and see more and reach more. So science is an enormously important part of our society, which has been, from our beginning.
Yeah.
And I must tell you, science applied to another man on the moon is one use of money, which I myself feel is a waste. It should be rather applied to science applied to consumers that number, again, something north of 50 million kids in this country alone. That's the role, you know. We're couch potatoes now, you know. A friend of mine was the man who created the phrase, that vast TV wasteland. Obesity is a matter of not using our legs as much and sitting around as much, you know. You don't reduce that by reducing the number of calories in the can of soda. You get up on your goddamn legs and you use them and, you know, your legs are bigger than your arms because you've had to do them over the eons against the... pull of gravity, and so they got to be bigger and stronger. The work ethic isn't quite as regular as it used to be. now represented by, I'm always available, I'm always on that. And so that 9 to 5, that 8 to 4, that 4 to 7, are not quite the way it used to be. We are going to be pursued by societies in which the work ethic is central. The Indian, the Chinese, even the Russian to some extent. And we've wandered with the work. So we've got to bring the kids back to some extent with the excitement of what science can be, as well as the romance of mathematics. Romance, I think. Art, certainly. Yeah. This may not all be helpful, but clearly this is not a clear path that you can pursue. And I wish the education secretary well, and clearly the American president. I spell it also P-R-E-C-E-D-E-N-T, which he is, and that's good. Big thing to do. And naming $90 billion or $200 billion ain't going to change it. Tomorrow we show up for class, and there we are in a structure that's 200 years to here. So there's an enormous thing to be done. Sputnik put us into the space race. Well, we started with a clean... I saw something that said the reason God was able to create the world in a period of 7 days was there was no installed base. Well, we've got an installed base. And thank you very much. And people of good cheer and hope are involved. That includes me. But it's an enormously complex thing. And let's try to reach for people's hearts and a little bit pocketbooks with recognition and cash as understanding that they at least represent a move forward and to be appreciated. So I'm all with XPRIZE on that and hope I can help.
So are you optimistic about this?
Yeah, I'm optimistic, but I'm also pessimistic. You know, I've been accused of being a futurist more than one time, so you can't be that unless you are optimistic. So it isn't a matter of optimistic or pessimistic. It's realistic. What's there? What could be there? What should be there? That's an optimistic thing, and that something can be created that isn't there now. I've been doing that all my life. But also it's a very real thing of... listen to the Reverend and see what he has to say about being pessimistic. You know, today, and he's Latino, as you know, and inspired.
This is the Reverend Miguel Rivera.
Yes.
Founder of the National Coalition of Latino Clergy and Christian Leaders.
Yes, yes.
Who spoke earlier.
And you know, the black community has been roughly 12 or 13% of the American population from the beginning. Well, today we've got the Latino population larger than they and just moving ahead. Between them, they represent at least 30% of the kids in school today, and that'll increase. 30-35%. Where are most of them going? To the schools that are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So realistic is we've got a real challenge there. And people of hope and intention have to be there every day seeing that happens.
He was making the point, though, that he was saying, if you think parents are not interested from my community, you're wrong. They're very much interested.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't have the language to express those interests. Sometimes they feel like it's not their place to go and challenge teachers at this point. But that all has to change.
Harlem? 20 years ago?
Yep.
10 years ago? Kids sitting there and not being talked to very much. These are very real things. So, how are you optimistic? Sure, we're optimistic about change, but the reality... Like, I have 7 years of military on the ground, you know that, and you get to be real in that thing, you know. Get to be real. So the reality is it's tough, and it's great for people of good purpose to want to do something about it, which is how we meet through the XPRIZE thing.
All right. Well, this is a series of ongoing conversations. I spoke to Chris Whittle early today, and Michael Horn again. We'll keep on this going this, and we'll have another conversation with you, see how we're doing a little down the line.
Oh, well, absolutely. You know, I'm at your beck and call.
Nelson Brahms, thank you very much.
Thank you.